The classical theory of fields which carry non-abelian charges and which can be coupled to matter. So first, just a reminder, a historical reminder. In fact, non-abelian gauge theories are very often called Young-Mills theory. Young-Mills theories. Because they were introduced around, I think, 1954 by Young and Mills. But for a long time, in fact, they were not really used in high energy physics because people couldn't. First, there were no massless gauge bosons either other than the photon in the spectrum of known particle physics, and also the quantization of these non-abelian gauge theories were very difficult to deal, and it took more than 20 to around 25 years for people to really understand how you can quantize such non-abelian gauge theories. And in particular, if you are interested in some of the historical aspects of the history of Young-Mills theory and how they became, in fact, the correct tool to construct modern theory of interactions, it's explained in many, many books. But there is a nice review that I refound recently by Toft, which was one of the important person in the proof of the construction of the consistency of Young-Mills theory and its applicability to high-energy physics. I think there is a review, a very short review and a conference, which is around 94 or 6, I don't know. So it's you can find it on the archive. But then you can find it in many, many books, too. So let us come back to what we have been doing. We are interested in having in constructing a theory which is associated to a non-abelian symmetry group. So we have a symmetry group G, which in practice I will take to be SU2, but it can be something else. And we saw that in order to introduce vector bosons, so vector particles with spin 1 carrying the charge of the symmetry group, we had to introduce a generalization of the electromagnetic potential. So we had to introduce a field A mu, which was in fact a collection of A mu A. So we can we could rewrite this as A mu A T A, where T A goes to 1 to the dimension of the group as a generator of the Lie algebra of the group. So it's a way to re-express. So this is the basis for the Lie algebra of the group. In particular for SU2, the TA are just, for instance, can be realized as the Pauli matrices. Is A equal 1, 2, and 3. And so that's a convenient way to reshuffle, to regroup in one single object this set of three different gauge fields. So this is, of course, something which depends on the position in space-time. And we saw that we have to derive from that, we can construct, so this is the gauge potential. And there are as many gauge potentials as there are generators of the symmetry group. And from that, you can construct a field strength, which is F mu nu. And the difference between the abelian case is that this is not only the ordinary anti-symmetric derivation. So it's not only the exterior, so if you want the curl or the exterior derivative of this form, but you have in addition to add something, a term which takes into account the fact that the symmetry group is non-abelian. So you have to to introduce the anti-commutator of those objects, because remember, for SU2, you can realize this object as 2x2 matrices. So in fact, the component of the gauge potential are 2x2 matrices, and therefore they do not commute, and you have to take their commutator in order to have an object which transforms in a simple way under the local gauge symmetry. Okay, and the local gauge symmetry, remember that the local gauge transformation, which is the analog of local gauge transformation in electromagnetism in the Maxwell theory, is simply that I change A mu of x into A mu of x plus something which is the covariant derivative of the local gauge parameter. So alpha of x is like before it's alpha A of x TA. So in fact you have three independent, you can make gauge transformation in three independent directions. So you have three independent functions for the gauge transformation. And the covariant derivative, something that's important, the covariant derivative so I will write it in this way, the covariant derivative of alpha of x is defined, or of any function living, but in particular of alpha of x, is simply defined by the ordinary derivative, alpha of x, minus I times the commutator of the gauge potential or the gauge connection with alpha of x. Okay? And and this is an arbitrary, in fact, arbitrary function of x belonging, of course, to space-time, namely the Minkowski space M13. Okay, so and from this we saw that it is possible to write an action. And today I will mostly concentrate on what's going on for the gauge field part. So we saw that it is possible to write an action. Pardon? Yes?
So how do we see
it as a spin one? It's a spin one because it carries one Lorentz indices. So it's a vector. You see? This will carry a spin one. AMU will describe the spin one field because, in fact, it transforms as a vector, an ordinary vector, under transformation. Therefore, if you want to go from one coordinate system x mu to a coordinate system x prime mu, which is given by some Lorentz transform, some lambda mu nu x nu, where lambda is a matrix of a Lorentz transformation, then A mu of x has to transform as it will become a prime mu of x prime, which will be well, the indices are below, so you have to take the inverse of the transformation. It will be lambda mu nu A nu of x, something like that. So it transforms as an ordinary vector. Okay?
So can we have a tensor particle?
Pardon? You?
Can we have a particle field that transforms like a tensor?
Yes, but if it would be a tensor, it would carry more indices. It would have two indices. For instance, you know that the gravity, it would be a spin 2 or a spin 3 or a spin 4. So basically, an object with two with just one indices is, as we expect, it's either a covariant tensor or a contravariant tensor. I never remember which one were covariant or contravariant, but it's a vector because by definition it's an object. A vector is a table of an object with components accorded which are just organized into a vector and transformed as a vector under the Lorentz transformation. Okay? Okay, so we saw that there was an action, and that the natural action for this classical action for this young midfield is simply an action. So I take an action which will depend on A, which is a classical action, and it is simply the it's simply the generalization of the action for the Maxwell field for a quant- for a, the Maxwell equation, and it is simply and with my notation in this will be F A mu nu, where I sum over those indices. And as we shall see, it's important that we can add to this a coupling constant that I will denote G squared. So this is the action for the, and it is just, so here F, I carry indices up and down simply by the standard multiplication by the metric tensor, and here the metric tensor is H mu nu equal with my notation plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, but it's not important as that's at that level since you have two indices. If you use the notation, for instance, in Peskin's book, where the signature is plus minus minus, you will get exactly the same expression. So it's not important. Okay. So so which means that F mu nu is just H mu rho H nu sigma F rho sigma. And then you sum over all indices. Okay. And that's, in fact, first it's just a generalization of generalization of the action for the U1 gauge series, which describes the Maxwell field. Okay. And I remember somebody asked me why not some F cube or F4. F cube is difficult because it's anti-symmetric. Or Fx terms, and the answer will be the same as for electromagnetism, because we want a renormalizable theory. But I will describe what renormalization means for this theory tomorrow, I think. Okay. Okay, so remember that if we want to couple this to fermions, for instance, we can add a term from the fermions, which is, if I add this to fermions, then I have to add a term which is of the form d4x, and this is simply psi bar I d slash minus m psi, where d slash is the covariant derivative for matter fields, which in the case of fermions in the fundamental representation, in fact, takes the same form than that. But in general, the covariant derivative will depend on the representation of the gauge group in which the matter fields lives. Okay, so it's also a covariant derivative, but it's not at almost. It's slightly. It can be different from this one, but it's defined in a similar way. Okay. So now I want to discuss what is the structure of perturbation theory. Perturbation theory that we expect from those this action and this Lagrangian, which is you see a sum over the group indices of the square of the electromagnetic of the stress energy tensor. Okay, and you see that in fact F mu nu written like that has a term which is linear in A and a term which is quadratic which is order 2 in A and which has some complicated group structure because here the commutator of the generator of the group starts to play a role. And you see that in fact here it makes sense to introduce a coupling constant here. G will be the coupling constant in the coupling constant because You see that if you start to think about trying to quantize this theory by constructing, for instance, a functional integral, you see that you expect that the fluctuation, the quantum fluctuation of the gauge field, of the gauge potential A, will be of order G. So you expect that the quantum fluctuation of A will be of order the coupling constant, because in a functional integral, you will have something like an exponential of... So I want to define something which is simply... Let me write it here, because I will not use it. I want to define some functional integral of the form. I integrate over the gauge potential configuration, and I have the usual rule to quantize the theory by path integral formulation, S of A. Okay? Where S is this action. And you see that the first term in this action is something, you have a term which is an integral d for x. You have a term of A divided by g squared in the action. And then you will have term of order A divided by g squared plus A divided by g squared. So you see that this is the term which is dominant, and you expect that the quantum fluctuation of mu will be of order g. So we can, in such, when you're expanding the action, we can just make a rescaling of the gauge. I make a rescaling by defining that a mu will be rescaled into g a mu of x. You see? So this is what I call now the gauge potential. And in doing so, in fact, you have to be a bit careful, because then it means that all the local, the symmetry properties, the way the gauge, the symmetry group acts on the field, depends on G. Because here this is perfectly homogeneous in A. Here I've introduced something which depends on G. Okay? So it's a good way to do perturbation theory, but it's a poor way to study the symmetry properties of the action. Because imagine that G is small. If G is small, assume that A in the functional integral is over the G. Then this is over the 1. Or if you prefer, it's over the G times square root of H bar, then, because you have a 1 over H bar. So this term is over the 1. This term is over the G. And this term is over, so this term is over the 1, this term is over order g, and this term is over order g squared. So as long as g is small, you can neglect those two terms and consider only the quadratic term in the action, which contains only the linear part in A in the stress, in the field strength tensor. They go like G, because here I am summing over the field configuration with a term which is an exponential of some function which of the gauge potential, and I am just using here the same kind of argument that we have been using when studying path integral formulation for the scalar field. You see, I assume that the minimum of S is for A equals 0. Okay, so I have somewhere a point where this exponential is maximum. So I have in the space of A some maximal field, you see here. And I'm going on looking at what's happening here. You see? And here I can, in fact, I realize that the maximum is for A of order of width, which is of order G. And in this region, I can neglect this term and this term. Okay? So it's exactly the same argument, which is very unwavering, but the same argument that we used to construct perturbation theory for the 5-4 theory out of the functional integral or the path integral formulation. Okay? Okay, so if I do this rescaling, then it's easy to see that, in fact, F mu nu becomes, in terms of this new field, F mu nu becomes so let us say F mu nu divided by G, because I have one G, becomes d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, and then I have a factor minus I times G times the commutator of the two gauge field. So this term is, this nonlinear term is a small perturbation compared to this term. Okay? And now what, yes?
Is there an arrow or equal?
It's an equality here. Oh, no, here I make a rescaling. So I redefine, if you prefer, I define that A mu nu equal G a tilde of A mu tilde, if you want, and then F mu nu divided by G becomes this. Okay?
So the thing on the right hand side is F mu nu tilde, or?
No, here is the original F mu nu. And you can define, if you prefer, this as F tilde mu nu, by definition. But then you must have a G here. You see? And similarly, the gauge transformation, there will be a G here. So you see that the covariant derivative will contain a term which is the ordinary derivative, and then a term proportional to G. Okay? Okay, so once you see that, if you want to expand this and apply what are the Feynman rules for the Feynman rules for expanding this term, you see that this, when you take the product of this, you have the product of this with itself. So you have a term which is quadratic in A, and I have first a kinetic term for A mu, namely, which is over order two, which is the same than for the Maxwell theory, except that now you have, remember, A mu has an index A, so there are in fact three different kind of gauge field. So in fact, I will not explain exactly what is the propagator at that point, but you expect that there will be now a propagator like that for the analog of the photon, because now you have three different photons. So a vector particle moving carries a Lorentz index because it's a vector, and it carries a color index because it carries charges. And you will have simply that there will be a delta AB because charge is conserved, because this term is just F mu nu A times F mu nu A. So you have conservation of color. There is a delta tensor between A and B. This is non-zero only if the incoming color is the same as the outgoing color. And then... Oh, I call, that's, I'm sorry. Those I will denote color indices, because often one speaks, in particular in the theory of strong interaction, which is called quantum chromodynamics. That's because the particle carries three indices, not those. In the theory of Young-Mills, the group is not SU2, but SU3. So in fact, there are eight A indices, but matter fields like the quarks carry three charges. And since there are three charges, in the history people were speaking about green, blue, and red, and therefore the theory was named quantum chromodynamics. So I will often denote this by color indices, but this is rather, in fact, group indices. So I have a delta function which tells me that the charges are conserved, and then I will have just, if I'm working well, the ordinary propagator for Maxwell's theory that you have studied in the CFT1 course. Okay? So we'll discuss what is this object later, but the moment is that for the moment you have a charge conservation because of this delta mu. Okay? But now, of course, you have also new terms which come from the fact that F mu nu contains also an anticommutator, commutator, and you can see easily that when you take the product of that with that, you have first will have a cross product term which comes from the product of this with this. So I will not. You can write it with all the indices. It's an exercise, but you can see that it corresponds to a three vertex where you have three vector fields which interact. So each vector field carries a group index and a Lorentz index. Okay, A, B, C refers to the group index, so are the charge carried by the particles, and mu, nu, rho are the Lorentz indices, so they refer to the spin carried by the particles. And if you remember what are the rules, the Feynman rules for that we discussed in the for quantization of the scalar fields, these particles so carry some momentum, so k is k, p and q are four momenta, so this in fact this propagator carry a momentum k which is a four momentum carried by the particles. So I should write this by capital letters because that's k, p and q. These are four momenta. And you have a factor associated to these vertices, this vertex, which is a combination of, so, which involves both the commutator of the generator of the field. So it involves the structure constant ABC of the group. And it's a proportional to G, remember, of the coupling constant, because here I have something which do not depend on G, and here I have something which depend on E. And then I have a combination of H mu nu and momenta, which makes that a vertex corresponding to something which is Lorentz invariant. And if you write well, you realize that this will be, there will be an H mu nu k minus p rho plus h nu rho p minus q mu plus h rho nu q minus k nu. Okay, that's the result of the calculation. So this carries the spin. This tells you how the spin and the momenta of the particle interact by this interaction term, and this carries the way how the currents, so the charges, are mixing during this interaction corresponding to this three vertex process where you have, for instance, one particle which splits and becomes two particles. You see? And you see that in this interaction, the charges changes because remember for SU2, that's something new. For SU2, you have three colors, A equal 1, 2, 3, and the structure constant of SU2 is simply epsilon ABC, where epsilon ABC is a totally antisymmetric tensor. Yes? So
the last term
I'm sorry, yes. It's rho mu. So in this way, this is completely symmetric in this. Okay? So you see that the charges are changes. They are not conserved. The total charge will be conserved in any physical process, but this interaction makes transform one charge into two different charges. Okay? And you see, for instance, that for SU2, it means that you have a one charge here. It cannot be conserved. It has to become a charge 2 and a charge 3, or a charge 3 and a charge 2. See? Okay? So this is for the three vertex, and similarly, you have a four vertex, which comes from the square of this. So you have also an interaction where 4 vector particles interact. They carry so color or group indices and Lorentz indices. So they carry spin and they carry charges. This is a term of order G squared. And if I made no mistakes, with the action which is I over h bar st, there is a factor minus I in front of that. And then there is a complicated term which involves products of two structure constant, where this is A, B, C, D are the charge indices carried by the incoming and outgoing particles, and E is an intermediate, so we take the products of two tensors, so you sum over this index E, okay, and then you have a factor which is H, or here I put the index up, why? In my notation here, they should be down, but I don't think it's at that level it's very important. So I have an H mu rho H nu sigma minus H mu sigma H nu rho. And then, in fact, you have, you can recombine things, so you have three different, you have two different terms, two different terms obtained by permuting all the indices, by permuting the legs, so that this expression becomes completely symmetric. So you see that. Okay. And you see, for instance, for that, for the SU2 group, this is the product of two completely anti-symmetric tensors. So for instance, this is the general expression, but for SU2, such a term become, in fact, it can be only zero if A, B are, if, for instance, A and B are different. Then E is the third one. Then E is the third one. Then C and D have to be different and the same than E and B. So this will be delta AC delta BD minus delta AD times delta BC. So you see that either the ingoing for SU2, either this charge comes out here, or in this, corresponding to this term, this charge either comes out here, or it comes out here. And this charge comes out here or here. So in fact, you see that in this interaction, the charge must be different. You cannot have two charges which are the same. And, the charges are conserved. You must have, some charge one incoming, some two here, and then some one will be coming out, and here or it, and with any permutation. So you see there are some symmetry in this interaction, but only for SU2. Yes? E is just, I am summing, E is the third index, and I am summing over E. I am always using the Einstein convention of summing over dim indices. So this means the sum over E's of A, B, E, F, C, D, E. But this can be rewritten without any E as, for SU2 only, as this tensor. Okay? So yes?
This action that you wrote down.
Yes.
It's, of course, gauge invariant, but it's also invariant under, is there a notion of a global Noether current here?
Pardon?
Is there a notion of
It has a global symmetry too. You mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this what action. Okay, this action is invariant under local gauge transformation. Okay, so in particular, also under global gauge transformation, because global gauge transformation corresponds simply to make a transformation where I change AMU into AMU plus, where with the factor I, d mu of alpha, where alpha of x is just a constant, independent on x. And you see that that's also symmetry. Yes? Pardon?
How come we don't have any like momentum?
Oh. Of course, here you have momentum, k, p, q, r, but this amplitude do not depend on the momentum. It's like for the 5-4 theory, the vertex doesn't depend on the momentum. So this is an interaction which is purely local and independent of the spin. And that's, in fact, that's an interaction which depends on the momentum of the theory. So it depends on the speed of one of the incoming particles, while this term do not depend on the energy and on the momentum, on the speed of the particle. Okay? But this comes out from the fact that we take for an action which is invariant, and of course it is invariant under Lorentz transformation. So, okay, so that's...
Because you've got the cross terms with the derivative in it.
Yes. Yes, that's because here I have a derivative for the term of order 3, while for the term of order 4, I have just 4 fields, and just the complicated interaction comes from the fact that the group structure, so the relation between the different currents of the theory, plays a role. Okay? Yes. Okay. So, okay, and the same for the matter field. So if you are interested into the matter field, let me just write this here. I have, and I will, let me keep that. Okay. If I had a matter field, so if I had fermions, 4 fermions, let us see that we have Dirac fermions. The fermions carry Dirac indices. Okay, but now they carry also charges. So alpha are the Dirac indices. So the alpha carry the information about the spin of the fermions. I are the charges associated to the carries information about the charges carried by the fermions. Remember that those are not the same because for SU2 the charges are only of 2 kinds for the fermions, while the charges carried by the bosons are of 3 different kinds. And so this is the usual propagation. So this is a delta I. There will be also a delta IG because those charges are conserved, times the usual propagator for a Dirac fermions. That's the usual propagator for a Dirac fermions. Okay, and you have an interaction terms between the gauge field and the fermions, G beta. And this term now is proportional to the coupling constant because that's a term which contains an A with 2 fermionic fields. There is a factor I. There is the usual gamma mu alpha beta terms which is the usual terms for the interaction of an electromagnetic current with the fermions. And finally, there is a term which is slightly more general than what's happening for the electromagnetic currents. It's what is this? It's a term which depends on the charge carried by the vector bosons. It depends on the charges carried by the fermions. And this is, in fact, simply the matrix element IG of the matrix TA corresponding to the generator TA of the Lie algebra of the group in the representation R in which the to which the fermions belongs. And in our special case of an SU2 group, so in the case of SU2 with the Dirac R in the fundamental representation, this is simply the matrix element IG of the Dirac matrix A with a factor 1/2. So those matrices are just the standard Dirac matrices. Okay, but so you see that now you have a vertex which is a product of something which contains an information about how the spin of the fermions and the spin of the vector particle, which is a spin one particle, interact, and that's the same than for electromagnetism, so same than for the U1. And then there is a term which tells you how the currents of the theory interacts, so it contains information about the group structure of the theory. This term is one for electromagnetism, for the U1 theory, but this is a more complicated term which depends on the current indices, of the symmetry indices, for a non-abelian gauge theory. See? Okay. So we seem in good track because it seems that we can construct a theory which is perfectly consistent for everything. But now here comes a problem, because we know that this theory, if you want to quantize it, will be plagued by the same problem than the problems that people encountered when quantizing electromagnetism, which is the fact that you have the problem of gauge fixing. The gauge fixing problem. Okay, and what is the gauge fixing problem? So the problem is that we want to define, if we assume that by the functional integral formalism, we want to define a functional integral, which is something I have written here, exponential I over h bar times the action for the gauge field, where this is the action. Okay, I will concentrate here on the pure gauge theory, because all the difficulties are contained in the pure gauge theory. And formally, so the SA is the action that we wrote, and DA is just a measure which is formally, it's very formal, but it's a product of all points of space-time, a product of all Lorentz indices, a product over all group indices of an integral over all the components, A mu A of the gauge potential at every point of space. So it's something which is defined in a very loose mathematical way, but basically you have to integrate over everything. Okay? But now we know that in fact this action, because of gauge invariance, If I make a gauge transformation, and it's enough to consider an infinitesimal gauge transformation. Okay. So, local gauge transformation means that at each point of space, I consider an element g of x which belongs to the group, here the SU2 group, which is the exponential. So if I consider of an infinitesimal gauge transformation, here is how I can write an infinitesimal gauge transformation at each point of space-time. So the TA are the generator of the group. So those are the Pauli matrices for SU2 divided by 2. And alpha A of x is the generator of the gauge transformation at the point x, you see? Okay, and I know that if I make this gauge transformation at each point, a gauge configuration that I will write like that, I forget about the index A here because it's contained, okay, it transforms into a new gauge potential, mu prime of x, you see, which depends on E, and we have seen that this is A mu of x plus something which is proportional to alpha, and we wrote it explicitly at the beginning of the lecture. This is simply of course, simply d mu of alpha of x. But d mu depends on a mu of x. Okay, we have, so it's a nonlinear transformation. So it's a transformation which starts to be a bit complicated. Okay, and we see that, in fact, for any general g of x, I can integrate this infinitesimal gauge transformation and write that a mu is transformed into, so this depends on g. This depends on g of x. Okay? In a slightly more complicated way. And let me write this as so it depends on g of x. At the moment, let's keep that like that. Okay? And therefore, by doing such a transformation, S of A is transformed into S of A prime, which is equal to S of A because of gauge invariance. Okay? So I'm not changing everything. And, well, I will not prove that here, but in fact, you can show that the measure is also unchanged. Okay? In this integral. So it means that, in fact, we are overcounting the configuration, because those two configurations are those two gauge configurations are completely physically equivalent. We are overcounting configurations which are physically equivalent, and in particular because they correspond to similar f mu nu. Well, there is a slight difference, but it's a transformation just by a gauge, a trivial gauge, local gauge transformation. Okay, so the physics of two different configurations, in fact, is exactly the same. Okay, and so we have the following problem, that in fact that, let me, I will try to explain something subtle just by drawing pictures. Okay? Yes?
The fact that the measure is also invariant.
Yes.
That's not very obvious, is it?
No, that's not in fact obvious, because you must define precisely what the measure is, and in fact the measure will be defined once we will have quantized the theory. So, in fact, what I will assume that the measure can be considered as invariant. I will do calculation as if it was invariant, and the spirit of the program of quantization is to take this hypothesis seriously, to derive sets of calculational rules, and then check at the end that we get a consistent field theory, consistent quantization procedure. And this consistent quantization procedure, in fact, will define the measure. So it's like some kind of bootstrap, but it's mathematically quite consistent. Okay, so I will write something. I will call capital curly A the space of all A of X, the space of all gauge potentials. Okay, and by A, I mean, in fact, A denotes, in fact, the data of all the A mu of X, you see? So I'm removing all the indices in group indices, Lorentz indices, and I call the data of this a point A. Okay, so A is a set of all gauge potentials. It's an enormous potential. Okay? Then I will denote by G the space of all possible gauge transformations at all points of space. Okay, so G will denote the data of a group element at each point of space-time. So here I have X in M, and mu and A are Lorentz and group indices. Okay, so at each point of space, I can assign an element of the group, of the gauge group SU2. So this belongs to the group G, which is in our case SU2. And so I'm giving a different element of the group. I'm performing a different gauge transformation here, like that, at any point of space. Okay? And now let me draw a picture to denote what is... I have this big space. Of course, it's an infinite dimensional space. And this is A. So I have an infinite dimensional space. And if I pick a point in space, this means that I'm picking a gauge field, a gauge potential configuration. So a point represents the data of a gauge field configuration known in any point in space, and all its components are known. Okay? And now, if I am making a gauge transformation on that, it means that by a gauge transformation, I am moving an A. This is a point A. If I make a gauge transformation, I am transforming A into this A prime. You see? So, by acting by a group G, I am making this transformation. Okay? So, I will denote, in fact, since I am using this connection, I will denote G by saying that the group G acts on the space A. G is a group. G is a huge group. So this is a group. This is a space. This is a very, very big group because it's a product of the group at each point of space time. So it's a huge product of independent groups. So G acts of A because to each configuration A, by the action of element of this big group, capital G, I get a configuration A prime, okay, that I will denote, in fact, in a very sketchy way, G of A. Okay? So to each, by a gauge transformation, by a factor G, I transform by a group group trans, by a gauge transformation. I transform gauge potential configuration A into a new gauge potential configuration A prime equal G of A. Okay, so I denote the element of the group and its action on the space by the same letter in order to be more sketchy, but that I'm denoting to a group, you see, and its representation is on space by the same letter. So don't be confused, but I hope it will be clear. Okay, so G acts of A, you see, and so any element of the group acts in a different way. So in fact, you have the whole image of any element of A. So the sets of all possible J of A, the sets of all possible G of A, for G belonging to this big group G, is called the orbit of the gauge configuration A by the action of the group G. You see? It's a cell of all images by transformation, by a gauge transformation of a given. Okay? And you see that all the gauge configuration on this orbit are physically equivalent. Physically equivalent. Okay? But now, of course, I have other field configuration. So let us call this A1, A prime 1. Let us consider here an A2. Okay, you have, of course, different orbits. And so you see that, in fact, the set of gauge inequivalent and hence physically equivalent configuration that I will be noted by let us call it since it's configuration, the set of physical configurations that I will be noted by a C. So this is a G, this is an A, is simply, in fact, the quotient, in the sense of mathematics, of the set of all possible gauge potential divided by the action of this big group G. Okay? So in fact, I don't have to, in the functional integral, if I want to be consistent, it's enough to sum, to make a function, a sum over all these slides. You see, because all the elements on the slides correspond to the same action, so I am overcounting them. Yes, you have a question? Some question? No?
Is that supposed to say inequivalent?
Yes, pardon?
Is that supposed to say inequivalent?
Pardon?
Is it supposed to say inequivalent?
Gauge inequivalent and physical.
Set of gauge? No, the set of gauge inequivalent and physically inequivalent. Oh, yeah, sorry. And physically distinct. Distinct, I'm sorry, distinct configuration is just the quotient of this big space by the action of the group. Okay? Yes?
Sorry,
this big group, G.
Yes.
Is this like an infinite dimensional D group or anything?
Yes, it's an infinite dimensional D group, which is not defined in a very well precise way because I'm not a mathematician. But no, because it's simply this group G, you see, it's simply the data of elements of a simple group, SU2, at any point of say. So this big group G, so this is an element of the group and this is a capital G. This big group G is simply the products, let us write it that way because it's a direct product, the products for each point of on space-time of the group G. So it's a direct product of the same group. It's the set of an infinite copies of the group at different points. So it's a very simple, from the point of view of a group structure, it's not a group which is not more complicated than the original group we started from the algebraic point of view. Okay. Yes? Okay. Okay, so what we have to do is, in fact, here, we have to integrate. And in order to integrate and to define, to be able to compute, what we have to do is to choose a slice. So we have to choose, for instance, we have to choose a slice here. For instance, this slice, I will call it, S1. And it's enough to consider to sum over gauge configuration one per slice. Okay? Because it will be enough to do physics with that. To choose a slice S, so to choose, let me, now I can just forget that. To choose a slice is something that we know very well in physics, and you have met already in electromagnetism. Choose a slice is nothing but what in physics we called choose a gauge. Okay? Because, in fact, if we fix a condition, if we choose a gauge, in fact, it's what is called the gauge fixing condition on A, on the gauge potential, we choose an element on each point. Okay? And so, choosing a gauge fixing condition is very well known. You know, for instance, that you can chase as a gauge fixing condition that A0 of x equals 0 at any point of space-time. A0 is just the time component of the vector potential. And it's known as the axial gauge in electromagnetism. And you have the analog of the axial gauge in non-abelian gauge theory. Simply, you have to fix an axial gauge for the three components of the gauge potential for the SU2. Okay? So, choosing the axial gauge amounts to choose among the orbits of A the specific A which satisfies this gauge condition. Okay? And then for another A, we choose the axial, so this is an example. But now you know that you have other gauge conditions. For instance, you can choose what is the Coulomb gauge. Okay? And the Coulomb gauge means simply that we consider that the divergence of the gauge potential just of the vector potential in the space dimension. So this is I equal, means this is just in the space dimension, equals 0. Okay, and you can do, of course, the same thing for the three components of the gauge field. Okay? And finally, I will use, in fact, so this is the axial gauge, this is the Coulomb gauge, and I will use in the calculation something which is very useful in non-abelian gauge theory. It's a gauge which, so I'm not always sure. Sometimes it's called, well, there are variants, so it's associated to the name of Feynman, the name of Landau, and to the name of Toft. So I don't know exactly which one it is. The advantage of this Landau, Feynman, Toft gauge is that it's a gauge which is invariant under, it's relativistically invariant, so invariant under Lorentz transformation. So I will fix this to be, in fact, something like that. I choose some arbitrary function. Arbitrary, but it's a scalar function. It's not a potential. It's a scalar function of space-time. Okay, and I assume that the divergence of this vector potential, but now it's something which is Lorentz invariance, is equal to this function. And in fact, I choose such a function for any of the relation. So I choose an omega A of X, and I fix that. So you see that, in fact, those different gauge fixing conditions correspond to choosing just different slides for, for this gauge fixing condition, okay? And there is, so you see that, in fact, choosing a slice is equivalent to choose a gauge fixing condition, and I will write also in a very compact way this gauge fixing condition, because I will denote such a condition, yes? Yes?
You know that this is not, and doesn't entirely fix the gauge, a covariant gauge fixing condition from ENM. Is there a geometric way of seeing that in that picture?
Yes. So in fact, here I am assuming that when choosing a slice, big assumption, let's hope that this fixes uniquely the element on each orbit. But in fact, of course, if you choose something in a different way, you may very well have that at some moment, get something like that. This gauge condition may fix three different conditions. Yes?
We know that's true, because we can choose at the same time the long gauge and the extra gauge.
I don't think so.
No.
You can either choose the extra gauge or the long gauge.
But like, when we quantify the magnetic field in a non-Lorentz invariant way, we choose the long gauge so that the A vector is not transverse. And we also say that the electric potential is zero. We are also choosing the actual gauge.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Yes?
I agree with him.
You agree?
Yeah, so you can use just one. Is it time dependent gauge transformations to set A0 wherever you want? And then you still have space dependent gauge transformations left.
Yeah, sometimes you still have some remaining degrees of freedom to fix. But I think if you do that, everything but something which happened for a given time, fixed time, is fixed. Something like that. So.
Still has some residual gauge symmetry as well.
Yes. So I'm treating this in a very sketchy way. So for the moment, let's say that you can choose a gauge, here are typical gauge, and sometimes you have to add something, some additional condition. Yes.
So will we have to integrate over all omegas too, because omega is arbitrary, so we have to...
We can choose one omega, and different omega will correspond to some slightly different gauge condition, for instance. Okay. In practice, this is useful because one can integrate over the omegas too, but that's a further step. Okay, you can choose, imagine that you have chosen a fixed omega, and therefore you have slightly different gauge fixing condition. Okay.
Was it a multivalued or double back on themselves like that? Those are bad choices of gauge fixing.
Yes. Yeah. So if you have that, it's very bad. If you have still a few remaining gauge fixing condition to enforce, that's okay. It's when you have done a lot of the job and then you have to work a little bit more. Okay. So you may have this plus something. Okay. Okay, so in fact, I think that only the axial gauge is known to be really free of those problems. But let us assume that I don't care about this problem. Okay? And I will denote this gauge fixing condition. So you see that in any case, this gauge fixing condition means that you consider that you have some function that I will call. So this is a function which I'll call the function GF for gauge fixing. I have a functional of A, which is a gauge fixing functional. So it's a function of a function. And so this gauge functional depends, of course, you have one gauge fixing condition per component of the gauge potential and one gauge fixing condition at any point of space-time. And I will denote everything by the fact that I assume that there is a gauge fixing functional, GFA of the gauge potential at point X, which is equal to zero. Okay? And I will denote that in a sketchy way, that GF of A equals zero. I mean that this considered as a function of space and of the group indices is a function which is always zero as a functional. As a functional. So this is an equation which is describes the value of the functional for X and A fixed. But it means that if you have a function of X and A which is zero for any X and any A, it means that the functional is zero. So the gauge fixing condition means that I have some functional on the space of gauge configuration, and the gauge fixing condition, which fixes where I am here, means that I'm choosing the A specific so that G of F is equal to zero. Okay? And now, well, I think it's good to keep that, so this picture, and anyway, I only have 5 minutes left, so now, of course, what we would like to do is to rewrite this integral by saying that we want to enforce that this condition, GF of A is equal to zero, in the functional integral, which is written in this very compact way, in order to reduce the integral onto one of those slices. Okay? So, of course, we cannot simply set this condition, because if we integrate this functional integral only on this slice, or on this slice, or on this slice, well, you can guess just from the picture that you will get different results. So if you just integrate over a slice, without taking into account how this slice is configured in the space of all configuration, you will get a result which will be not be gauge invariant, because you will get a result which is different from this slice and from this slice, where those three slices are just different ways to compute the same thing, quantity, which should be gauge invariant. Okay? So here is a beautiful trick, which is due to Feynman and DeWitt, and to, independently, to Fadeyev and Popov, which tell you how to fix the gauge, keeping how fix the gauge, keeping gauge invariance. Okay? And the trick is simply to, in fact, to make something crazy, to multiply it and then divide by the volume of the gauge group. So I will rewrite this simply as, you see, you have to realize that for any, if you choose a gauge fixing condition, so you choose a GF, okay? For any A, there is a G, okay? Such that GF of G of A is equal to zero. It means that simply that if I choose the GF, the gauge fixing condition one associated to this slice, so this gauge fixing condition GF1 equals zero means that it's slice, for any A, I can make a gauge transformation which carries me to the slice. So for any A, there is a G such that GF of G of A is equal to zero. Okay? So, let me write this functional integral over all the field configuration as simply the integral over A over all configuration, field configuration. Then I integrate over the group G. I integrate over all gauge transformation. And then I remove this integration by fixing, by choosing the gauge transformation G such that G is equal to minus this G1 of A. Let us say G1 because this function G1 is associated to the choice of the gauge function GF1. Okay? With GF1, G1 of A is defined such that GF1 of G of A equals zero. So it's a solution of this equation. And that's an integration over this big gauge group here. And this is a Dirac delta function on the group G. Okay? And, okay, so I have, you see, I am integrating over a big group and I fix a constraint that G is equal to this GA1. You see?
So
yes?
I don't quite understand why we started with the assumption of gauge invariance.
Yes.
And we picked a gauge and somehow we lost gauge invariance.
For the moment, I have not lost gauge invariance because here, this is something which this is 1, you see. This is equal to 1. You agree that and I integrate over something times the delta function of G minus something, I'll always get 1. So this is gauge invariant, and this is 1. For the moment, I have not lost any gauge invariance.
But what is the problem that we're trying to fix?
Yes.
I think that's good. Why do we need the finite trick?
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, I should have explained that sooner. I wanted to explain that once I get the result. We need to fix the gauge for exactly the same reason that you need to gauge fixing when quantizing by canonical quantization the Maxwell field. That's because if you don't know gauge fixing, okay, the action for A and the function for G of A is the same. This means that you have flat direction, if you want. You have flat directions in for S of A. Because S of A is equal to S of G of A for any G. Okay? This means that when you start to do perturbation theory, remember, the propagator for the gauge field, mu nu, should be equal to, in fact, remember, it's the inverse of the functional derivative of the action of A when I make two functional derivatives with respect to the gauge field at two different points. You see? That's a general definition of the propagator in any quantum field theory. We have seen that for the case of the scalar field, but it's a general procedure. So the propagator for the vector field is something like that. And you have already this formula for the U1 gauge field, so it's true for U1. U1 as well as SU2. So it's something you have tried to compute by canonical quantization in the Maxwell theory. But you see that if the action is the same for gauge configuration, it means that this this object as many zero modes. Because if I make a variation, if I choose a delta A mu, which is equal to just a gauge transformation, delta of S is equal to zero. So it means that this matrix in the space of gauge configuration has zero modes, therefore it cannot be inverted. Not, hence, not invertible. Okay? And if it's not invertible, it means that this is not well defined. Okay? Because it means that when I integrate in this direction in the space of field configuration, if I make my functional integral like that, I always get the same result. So I cannot apply I cannot do a perturbation theory. I cannot apply the Vick theorem because the propagator is not invertible in this direction. Okay? So the propagator is in fact not well defined because of gauge invariance. And therefore, the only cure for this is to fix a gauge. But to do it in a way which preserves the total gauge invariance of the theory once you compute things. So the reason for why we need gauge fixing is exactly the same for non-abelian gauge theory than for abelian gauge theory.
I think we understand. It's a very good explanation, but I think the question was slightly different. Question was that why do we actually need to do the Feynman-Dirich trick to implement the gauge invariance.
I have not yet explained what is this trick. Okay. I just started to explain the first step, and I think I will stop there because otherwise it will last too long. I wanted to explain is that if you fix the gauge by just saying that in this integral I restrict my integration, so I decide to decide over the gauge configuration on this space, or on this space, or on this space, it turns out that for non-abelian gauge theory, and that's a specificity of non-abelian gauge theory, you get different results. And that's a problem which, for some reason that I have no time to explain, it will become clear at the end. There is some miracle in the Maxwell theory, in the U1, in the abelian gauge theory, which makes that you can just choose a gauge, quantize, get something. Choose another gauge, quantize, you get the same result. And that's something that you can do in canonical quantization. I don't know exactly which kind of gauge you have been using in canonical quantization, but you can check that with most reasonable gauge, you get the same result. And that's true, for some reason, only for the abelian gauge theory. For the non-abelian gauge theory, if you choose the axial gauge and do calculation, it's a bit complicated, but it can be done. If you choose, I think you can do that with this omega. If you choose this lambda of Feynman-Toft gauge for different omega A, you find the result. So you integrate over this, or over this, or over this, you get a result which depend on omega A. Okay, and this will become clear later. And not only you get results which depend on omega A, but you realize that you find the propagator which is well defined, but where the longitudinal modes, which are the unphysical mode of the photon, play a role. And remember, in our theory, now we have a coupling between like that, between photons. So you may very well have that if you start from a transverse mode, okay, you compute a propagator between transverse modes, you may have virtual longitudinal modes propagating in a Feynman diagram like that if you are computing a quantum process and a radiative correction to a quantum process. And this leads you to violation of unitarity, because you know that the longitudinal modes are very bad. Okay? So, not only If you are just integrating over that, you get something which is not gauge invariant. But also, it is not consistent quantum theory. Because the longitudinal modes couples with the transverse modes, the physical modes, and therefore you get negative probabilities, probabilities higher than one. You get some states of your theory which have negative norm states. That's a disaster. Okay?
Can you think of it as the subspaces that we're picking out having different volumes?
So having, sure.
Well, we're picking a subspace of this space,
yes.
A.
Yes.
So do they somehow have like different volume modes?
Yes,
it's
like that.
Is
in
that
fact,
a way to think about it?
In fact, it's something. This will become clear tomorrow. It means that, well, let us draw this picture. No, it's okay here because it's a bit, but you see that, for example, if you sum naively, you see that this, let us consider what is the contribution of this, this part of configuration space. You see, and it starts to be a little messy, but so let us try another. Do I have something I've not used? Yes. Wow. Okay. So you see that if I choose to integrate over this part with this gauge condition, or with this part with this gauge condition, you see that naively, the volume of this slide, so that's a slice, and that's a slicing, and that's the transverse part, so this shell, if you want, this shell, if I consider that this shell is represented by this element, or if I consider that this shell is considered by this element, here it will have a contribution which will be smaller than this one. Because here it's curved, it's not orthogonal in some sense, so it's bigger. So here I get something which is bigger, and here I get something which is smaller. Okay? But of course, this represents the same shell. I have some kind of shell. The shell in configuration space. And it is only this concept of this shell which is gauge invariant. So I have to find what is the correct way to define a volume for this shell, okay, which do not depend on the way I represent it either by this slicing or by this slicing. You see? And this is what I will be doing starting from this stupid idea to multiply this by one. Well, it's not my idea, it's the idea of this great physicist, which consists in inserting one represented in a very complicated way as an integral over the gauge group, and then starting to play with this idea. Because that's the correct way to assign, to put a measure on this slice, and the measure of this slice, which will be the correct measure, so that the measure for this and the measure for this is the same. So we have to define what is the real volume of this part and what is the real volume of this part. Okay? Okay, so, but we shall do that tomorrow. We'll have plenty of time, so we can do it at length. Thank you.
So you really should integrate over all of them. You should only integrate over one.